We are pleased to inform you that you have a place at Potterversity.
Welcome to Potterversity, a Potter Studies podcast. This is episode 39, Considering Cockroach Clusters, Food in the Wizarding World, Part 2. Thanks for joining us at Potterversity. Today, Emily Strand and I will talk with Louise Freeman and Emma Nicholson about food in the Wizarding World. I am Katie McDaniel, professor of history at Marietta College in Marietta, Ohio, and co-editor of Harry Potter for Nerds 2.
And I am Emily Strand, instructor of comparative religions and cultural competency at Mount Carmel College and author of several Harry Potter essays.
Well, we had so much to talk about in our last episode on wizard food, which is episode 29. So it's 10 episodes back, if you want to catch that. We decided that we needed to have another one on food. There's too much to say.
Yes.
And listeners, y'all should stay with us to the end, because in our special segment today, we are going to visit the Hogwarts kitchens for some fun recipes that you can try for yourself at home. So I'm really excited to get into this. Joining us for our return to refreshments in the Harry Potter universe is Dr. Louise Freeman, Emerita Professor of Psychology at Mary Baldwin University and licensed behavior analyst. A service provider for special needs children, Louise has written a number of articles about Harry Potter and other young adult literature and psychology. She blogs at the Farting Sofa Faculty Lounge at fartingsofafaculty.blogspot.com. Also joining us today is Emma Nicholson, our wonderful technical director and Harry Potter expert in her own right. Emma writes about the Harry Potter and Star Wars worlds at Archive of Our Own, specializing in constructing timelines to reveal overlooked aspects of both plot and characters. You can find Emma on her website, Tragic Gift, where she blogs about personality development and neurodiversity and hosts the Positive Disintegration podcast. Welcome back to the show, Louise and Emma.
So glad to be here. It's great.
Thanks, Katie. It's great to be here.
Now, Emma, you pointed out to us after episode 29 that as an Australian, you have a different response to some of the Wizarding World food that we Americans, Emily, Louise, and I talked about on the last food episode. So what were some of the differences that you were thinking about as you listened to that episode?
Well, that episode was very interesting because it sparks so many thoughts, and often as I'm editing, I'll make notes and send messages to you guys about what I'm thinking. But particularly the taste thing stood out to me as very different, because I suppose growing up in Australia, I have quite a different palate. So I've been to America a couple of times, and you know, I really enjoy the food there, but I do find that some of the things taste surprisingly different. Even things like, you know, simple things like bread. We've got a bit of a different palate in Australia. I think it's more geared towards salty, umami kind of flavors. And being so close to Asia, we have a lot of influences from there. And, you know, this is the land of Vegemite after all.
Vegemite, Marmite.
So my interpretation of some of the things you brought up was a little bit different. And I think I'd start with butterbeer being, I guess, synonymous with the Potter world, and everybody, you know, if they go to the theme parks, they want to try the butterbeer. And it was actually quite shocking to me when I went to the Warner Brothers tour in Levensdon in London, like how sweet their representation of butterbeer was. Mm-hmm. And I think you guys would also have a very sweet interpretation. But when I was reading the books, I thought of beer. And right. As yes. an Aussie, we love our beer ice cold, and it doesn't surprise me that the English like warm beer anyway. So Harry's description of it being warm wasn't a surprise, but he never actually describes what it tastes like. He just says it was one of the best things that he'd ever tasted and that it was warm. So when I thought of butter beer, I actually thought of the concept of butter chicken curry. I know that's a weird association, aww. But the fact that the English butter chicken was actually made for them in India to accommodate their palate, but it still retained the essential spices of Indian curry. It was just milded down with a butter sauce. So for me, I would have expected butter beer to still have elements of that beer taste, but be a sort of milder, creamier version of beer. I didn't expect it to be like butterscotch.
Yeah, I think that actually when I first heard about it, I thought of almost like a shandy where you have beer, but it's been diluted so that it's much lighter and it's even something that underage people can drink without becoming terribly intoxicated unless they drink too much.
But, you know, Americans particularly, I mean, are not into like children having any kind of, you know, even a very low, even near beer or something that.
That's
like,
not that's, okay.
It's not okay, right?
Over here.
But we do really push sweets, like sugar sweets. And, you know, I remember exchange students and people that I've known from Asia who've come to the United States who are just like, there's so much sugar, and that sugar has its own taste, and they can't taste anything else over the sugar. And it's just really different. Like you say, it's a palate difference that I just found that really interesting. And of course, for butterbeer for us, we're like, oh, it's the best thing he's tasted. It must be really sweet.
Well, I will confess that when I visited the Wizarding World in Florida, I thought that the butterbeer was sickeningly sweet. But I do, my husband and I both have a little bit of a sugar avoidant sort of palate. You know, we recognize like what you said about the bread even tasting different over here, Emma. And that's because there's sugar in a lot of bread, which to us makes zero sense unless you're making a sweet bread. But if you want sandwich bread, there's no reason for it to have sugar or high fructose corn syrup in it. But it's you know, you have to search a little bit to find those breads that don't contain added sugars. And so when I tasted the butterbeer, I had already made my own butterbeer and I thought it was very good, but I had made. But in Florida, I was like, ooh, this is really, at the time I was pregnant, so I was kind of okay with it. I was like, this is okay. But yeah, it did taste too sweet to me.
I've always thought it was very interesting because my assumption has always been that butterbeer was like a very, very mild alcoholic beverage, which is something we don't have really in our culture. We either have, you know, non-alcoholic that is, you know, suitable for anyone, or alcoholic beverages that are only for adults.
In Europe, I guess the attitude towards younger people having some form of alcohol, although not in great quantities, is a bit more prevalent than maybe in the United States, because your legal drinking age is actually quite high compared to a lot of places. So here it's 18, whereas over there it's 21.
And it almost seems as though the magical world has this mild alcoholic beverage, butterbeer, that can't really get students drunk, can only get, you know, the house elves drunk if they get too much of it.
Yeah, in the sense that really we only see house elves getting wasted on it, you know, or particularly Winky, poor thing, getting wasted on it. And students are drinking.
That's presented as really like some sort of unusual feature of the house elves that she would be able to get, you know, so drunk off butterbeer.
Right. Or drinking it to that excess, you know.
Yeah, I did wonder, like, is butterbeer beer? I remember thinking that, like, does it have any alcoholic content or like just a tiny bit or something? And that's so interesting.
Some, because Ron says it's not very strong stuff. So there's obviously something in it.
Oh.
It's not totally non-alcoholic.
Yeah. Right.
But it's almost like this step into the adult world that they can take very gradually. You know, they can start drinking butterbeer before they drink, say, fire whiskey.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Or mead or something like that.
And it's almost like training wheels.
Yes, exactly. And I think it's very interesting, of course, that we don't have anything like that in our culture. We don't have any way of introducing young people to alcohol in a milder form. And maybe it would be better if we would. I remember when I started drinking coffee, you know, my dad would make very, very weak coffee with lots of hot milk and sugar in it. And that's how I started drinking coffee. And by the time, you know, I was an adult, I was able to, you know, handle, you know, stronger, full strength black coffee. But I got introduced to it at this very young age through very, very weak coffee, or, you know, sometimes parents will give kids very, very weak tea and sort of get them used to the caffeine in a lower dose mm-hmm. before they start drinking it regularly.
And to acquire the taste for it too.
That butterbeer seems to do that for wizarding kids at a young age.
I'm going to throw the brakes on for a second. You guys don't have low alcohol beer over there?
We do. It's near beer, but it's not. It's what people drink who are trying to give up alcohol. This is my
or pregnant women, or I mean there's a range of alcohol volumes with different beers. You know, you can have a Coors Light and you're going to get, or you can have a Michelob Ultra or whatever, and you can, you know, have a much lighter alcohol level than if you drink some craft beer that's at 8-something%, you know. People make those choices, but I would say yeah, it's not as much of a thing. It's just something that you do have to kind of pay attention to.
And we don't have a 2% beer that's okay for 15-year-olds.
No. Right. That's what I was going to say, right? There's no expectation that kids would be brought into that world. I mean, I do think there's something in our like puritanical origins where we're kind of all or nothing, and it does, I think, create a tendency for, you know, the prevalence of binge drinking among young people and all that, that I don't think is ultimately all that healthy. And I do think our drinking age is too high here, and it makes it forbidden fruit, and then and people don't learn how to imbibe properly. So let's talk about intoxicating beverages. How do we think the series in general is portraying intoxicating foods and beverages? And, you know, I'm thinking about fire whiskey, and Hagrid has some interactions with fire whiskey, but also the house elves and butterbeer. What does this tell us about the wizarding world? And what do you think we should take from this portrayal?
I don't think intoxicants are portrayed particularly well. While we have obviously this weird cultural difference of teenagers drinking a low alcohol beverage, alcohol's mostly seen in a negative light in the series. So, I mean, apart from Hagrid getting drunk over Buckbeak when he's celebrating, most of the times when we see people drunk, it's when they're in emotional pain. And a lot of the role of alcohol in the series is actually as a manipulation mechanism. So to the first one of emotional pain, we see Hagrid getting drunk over the stuff Rita Skeeter says. And Hermione's like, Hagrid, I think you've had enough. And she takes the tankard outside and empties it, and he sticks his head in the barrel. And we also see him and Slughorn getting drunk over Aragog. There's Sirius drinking alone when he's stuck in Grimmauld Place. Then you've got people like Winky and Sybil who are drinking when they're in abject misery. So it's either framed in that way, or it's framed in a way where people are being manipulated by it. So Romilda Vane hides that love potion in fire whiskey chocolates, and someone gets Hagrid drunk, so, you know, and promises him a dragon egg, so he's going to spill the beans on Fluffy. And even Harry, after Aragog dies, he magically refills the bottles so that Slughorn will get drunk so he can get that memory out of him. So there's a lot of manipulation with alcohol going on, and there's a lot of alcohol being used in less than happy circumstances to support people in emotional pain, which, you know, we know is not always the best solution.
Right. Yeah. I guess, Louise, what would you say about that? I mean, I think that's an interesting, and it's very psychological what Emma has said.
Well, it's interesting because I was thinking about Harry's first drink of fire whiskey, which I believe was the toast they drank to Mad-Eye Moody after he died.
Mm.
And I think that was sort of a initiation or a sign that, you know, the Order of the Phoenix or the other adults, with the possible exception of Molly Weasley, were seeing Harry as an adult now. Because before, I mean, you know, we had seen him drink butter beer and things like that. But after Mad-Eye dies, and of course, Mad-Eye dies right after the Seven Potters thing where they have fled from Privet Drive and Hedwig gets killed. And mm-hmm. I remember a quotation from J.K. Rowling that, you know, Hedwig's death sort of signaled the end of Harry's childhood because, you know, of that very tragic loss and that, you know, this was now going to be Harry stepping into the adult world and fulfilling his destiny, not as a child, but as an adult. And so, you know, they have this escape. Mad-Eye dies as a result. And then Bill goes and gets the fire whiskey and everybody drinks a toast. I don't remember if they included Jenny in that toast or not, because Jenny was the one, only one at that point who was still underage or very close to it.
Hmm.
But, you know, I remember them drinking that fire whiskey toast to Mad-Eye and that being a way of honoring him and a way of sort of acknowledging Harry and Ron and Hermione for that part as, okay, you're part of the Order now. You are part of the Warriors of Voldemort. This is real. You're not school kids anymore. You are adults.
Well, right. And of course, Harry is leaving his childhood home for the, you know, basically for the last time. And and this is part of, you know, you're right. What's being acknowledged there with that drink.
Well, and I was thinking this relates too with what you were saying about butterbeer being a kind of first entree into that, you know, kind of adult world as a, you know, adult beverage, but that doesn't have a lot of intoxicating qualities. And then now in this moment, you know, he's drinking the fire whiskey, but also I'm interested in that is almost like a warrior's salute. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
To down the fire whiskey as just a, like almost like as fellow soldiers might do, and that it's serving some kind of like bonding and memorial role there as well. And I'm struck by how much more positive that is. And, you know, the like Hagrid dunking his head in a barrel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is interesting. I think that we don't see any of the trio like having alcohol in the tent, you know, as they're traveling around. Of course, they were short on food, and it was a very impoverished existence there with them not being able to find necessarily good foods to eat. But you didn't see them actually seeking out drink in that under those circumstances. So it was sort of interesting is that once they were on their own, they didn't seem to be attracted toward that element.
Yeah. Now, let me ask you all this. Do you think Felix Felicis is an intoxicant? Because Harry feels real good after he drinks it. And it gives him a kind of confidence that seems, I don't know, a little high. I don't know. What do you all think?
I will just offer that at my previous Harry Potter parties, Felix Felicis was a royal gin fizz,
ooh,
which was absolutely delicious and delightful, not for the faint of heart,
strong,
and definitely, definitely made you feel lucky. A beautiful drink.
Oh, that's funny.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's sort of hard for me to separate. You know, there was the whole Daniel Radcliffe, which was one of his funniest scenes ever when he was playing Harry kind of high on Felix Felicis in terms of, you know, he was doing the whole little imitation of the spider clicker pincher type things at the funeral. I mean, Daniel Radcliffe was playing Harry as if he was drunk then. And I don't think that's the way it came across in the book. It certainly didn't, I didn't pick up on that. It was just sort of that, you know, Harry was sort of going with his gut. It's like, no, I think I should go see Hagrid. No, no, Harry, you need to go find the memory from Slughorn. No, I think Hagrid's is the place to be tonight. And he's just sort of following this pathway, you know, kind of following his instincts, you know, as opposed to the way it turned up in the film, which was basically Daniel Radcliffe acting like he was a bit high.
Yeah, but I wonder if those are related, you know, in the sense that we kind of think when you have some of those inhibitions and that logical voice of reason stripped away by an intoxicant, you're more like in tune with in your intuition or your gut. I think that some people might feel that.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. I always got the impression that Harry was planning a lot more in the book than he was in the movie version of that. He seemed to be actively thinking, okay, if I can get Slughorn to do this, I can get him to share the memory.
I think it comes down to what is the action of the potion, because if it alters your brain chemistry in some way, as Louise was alluding to, if it's actually, you know, stripping out something else or feeding you into your intuition or making you think in ways that you wouldn't normally think, then yes, it's an intoxicant. If it's some magical thing that simply changes the circumstances of events around you without altering your brain, then it wouldn't be. So I think it depends on what the action of the potion is, and is it altering your fundamental brain chemistry? Because amortentia, absolutely, I would say it's an intoxicant. I mean, you look at poor Ron, he's so love drunk when he has it, because his brain's been altered.
Yeah, whereas the Felix Felicis, I think, in the book, it did seem to be alternating the circumstances. Like it, you know, Jenny got offended that Dean was trying to help her through the portal hole, and she got mad at him, and that led to them breaking up, which of course was the luckiest thing in the world for Harry at that point, because Harry was in love with Jenny and he really needed Jenny to dump Dean. It was also, I think, luck in the sense of Lavender Brown coming along and seeing, you know, Ron and Hermione going out through the portal hole together and not realizing Harry was with them and feeling like Ron's being unfaithful, and, you know, that leading to their breakup as well. And so I think in the book it was much more of a circumstance altering potion as opposed to a mental intoxicant type thing.
I'm interested to, I think this could bear some fruit on, so to speak, on a analysis, like actually kind of getting into the scenes and really analyzing them. Maybe somebody will take that up for a future paper. So one of the things that I actually tell my World Civ class is we don't think about caffeine as intoxicating, but actually it is in a way. It's
an
addictive stimulant. Yeah, and you think about people who have to have their coffee, like it's definitely that. And so let's talk a little bit about, there's not a lot of coffee in the series, but there is some tea going on in the series. And what do we think about? This is, of course, it seems like a quintessential British tradition, tea. And it's also serving a really important cultural role as a kind of food ritual that we might look a little more deeply into in terms of what it means for the Wizarding World. So what do we think of how some of these Wizarding World teas play out? And I'm thinking about, you know, Mrs. Weasley and Tonks sharing tea and sympathy. And also then, of course, we've got Madame Puttyfoot's shop that plays a role in, you know, kind of teen romance. What do you all think?
I guess how much of this is just sort of British culture and how much of this is, you know, specific to, wizarding culture and specific to the Harry Potter series?
Well, I know one thing I've noticed since I've been reading the Cormoran Strike series, of course, is that everybody is constantly offering tea or coffee. I mean, it really doesn't matter. Rich, poor, business, home, anything. If you walk in through the door into someone's office or home or anything, and you are a guest, you are offered tea or coffee, and usually biscuits too, or cookies too. And, you know, as much as Americans love tea and coffee, I don't think we are that committed to handing someone a cup of it as soon as they walk in through the door. I mean, if we offered water, that would be considered polite. And I can definitely see that in the British culture, you know, offering tea or coffee is incredibly important. And of course, you know, it comes up a lot, particularly in that series.
Yeah. So maybe it is more, you know, of a British thing, but it's so thoroughly incorporated into the wizarding world. And Madame Puttyfoot's, it's a particular kind of tea shop, right? That is kind of over the top and, you know, it's your dating spot, I guess. You might think about also, of course, maybe this is a little more magical, tea reading, right? Reading the tea leaves that they do in Professor Trelawney's class. And so there's tea that has a prophetic kind of feel to it.
The tea serves that connection between the real world and the wizard world. Hmm. It's sort of like saying there are some things that still carry through to the wizard world. We're not completely, you know, doing our own weird magical things over here. Tea is a very human, emotionally connected thing. And by playing that out through the wizarding world, I think it's sort of shown that these are still people. You know, when we go on a date, it's what people do. Do you want to go grab a cup of coffee? So, you know, going to the tea shop is the same thing. You know, when someone's upset, we make them a cup of tea. So it's what Ron does for Hagrid. And they're like, what are you doing? He's like, making tea. Well, it's what Mum would do. So it's sort of embedding that notion that there's some things that don't change. And even the reading of tea leaves, it's not something that's particular to the wizarding world. It's a form of divination that we're already familiar with in our own lives that, you know, people have been doing for quite some time. So I think in some way it sort of puts that human element into the wizarding world. And what's interesting for me is the scene where Umbridge tries to slip Harry the Veritaserum into a cup of tea. Mm. It's like she knows that this is a traditional signifier of friendship and emotional connection. And it's almost like Harry knows she's being false with this, even though she's trying to fake it. Like she fakes it with all her pink bows and her girlish laugh and her kittens, and she's faking it with a cup of tea, you know, which is a dire insult in my book. But it's like there's this understanding that tea has this cultural significance, and it's not just a significance that's particular to the wizarding world. And I think that's why it's important, because it makes that connection to the real world, even in the reading of tea leaves.
Yeah, I love that, seeing it as a bridge. And I also like how, because tea is supposed to be this, you know, binding agent and also soothing and, you know, friendship and hospitality and so on, as Louise was mentioning too, that to lace it with Veritaserum, it just marks you as a betrayer. And that is just a revelation of who Umbridge is at that particular moment.
And the other incident I can think of that is the fake Mad-Eye Moody, Barty Crouch Jr., when he invites Neville to his office to have a cup of tea. You know, when Neville is upset about the unforgivable curses and seeing the Cruciatus curse. And I remember how Harry was thinking, wow, this is such a great thing for this professor to do, to be concerned about this student who was upset by this lesson and inviting him in for tea and stuff like that. And of course, we know that was also a act of treachery or act of duplicitousness.
Mm-hmm, in terms manipulation.
Of trying to get
mm-hmm.
Neville to pass Harry the information about
the gillyweed, right?
Gillyweed, mm-hmm. and yeah, things like that. He was manipulating things behind the scene. But I remember how touched Harry was about this kindness that he was showing Neville, and of course that was also something very similar.
Oh my gosh, Harry read the situation wrong. I'm shocked.
Yes, he did.
That's crazy.
Right. There's another tea situation he reads wrong, and that's Dudley and the cold cup of tea, which he initially assumes is a booby trap. And then it's almost like when Dudley shakes his hand, he thinks about the cup of tea and goes, oh, Dudley made me a cup of tea. Like it really sort of touches him, that thought that, you know, Dudley wasn't trying to booby trap him. He was actually making a nice gesture towards him. So he misreads that one too.
Right. It's like, it is. It's like this basic gesture of warmth to another person, you know, offering tea.
But of course it's not without its potential pitfalls. I think that's one of the things that we're hearing too, that you can read the tea leaves wrong, which of course that happens a fair amount as well.
Trelawney does more often than not.
Yeah. And you know, who is Harry at Madame Puttyfoot's with? The wrong girl in a way. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So there is this, you know, potential for reading it wrong and for getting that message like totally backwards. Well, okay. So Emma, tell us a little bit about pumpkin juice and your thoughts on pumpkin juice.
That one threw me for a loop when Louise mentioned pumpkin spice, because I know over there you are all about your pumpkin spice, especially as it goes to autumn and into winter. But it is, I can guarantee you, it's a purely American phenomenon and no one over here. What is pumpkin spice? Because we don't have pumpkin pie. And I had an experience where I went to Thanksgiving in Canada and they served up pumpkin pie. And I'm like, this doesn't taste like pumpkins. What is going on? It tastes like I was completely confused. So I am familiar with what pumpkin spice tastes like. But when I read the books, so I was thinking along the lines of when you go to those juicing bars where they throw carrots and apples and everything through the industrial juicer and you walk away with a fresh vegetable juice, I'm thinking, you know, pumpkins and maybe a bit of lemon or apple or ginger in it. But I was thinking fresh vegetable juice, not pumpkin spice at all. That one really... as we say over here in cricket terminology, hit me for a six.
Hit you for a six. Well, what's interesting to me, I think I did say this at the end of the last episode on food, that pumpkin is a New World food that, you know, was an American, pumpkins were American, but they've become really associated with Halloween and also with things like witchcraft, you know, and you know, kind of like pagan celebration and so on. And so I found it really interesting that it featured so prominently in, you know, British boarding school setting in the magical world, partly because that seems like actually it's an import, but you know, tea is an import as well. so many food things, you know, get, you know, it's not like Italy had tomatoes before Columbus. So
I have to say a pumpkin juice was very tricky to try to make before there was, you know, before you could buy it at the Wizarding World or whatever. So
yeah, pumpkins are not juicy. Pumpkins are not really juicy.
You cannot, we did try juicing pumpkins and they're not juicy and it tasted terrible. What we ended up doing was we bought, you can get pumpkin spice tea bags. Okay. And like pumpkin spice flavored tea, and which isn't sweet. It's just, it's tea bags. So we would make tea and then we would juice the tea with like maybe, you know, three parts tea or four parts tea and one part, like some kind of sweeter, like a carrot juice mixed with some other juices. So we added some sweetness to it and it was lovely. And, you know, I still make it sometimes in the fall. And it's a lovely beverage, but it's the right, to me, it's the right level of sweetness. Again, I'm here to confirm that the Wizarding World in Florida, their pumpkin juice was just overly, overly sweet, just ridiculously sweet.
I'm thinking the wizards cheated, to be honest. I reckon it's like when you pick up vegetable juice from the supermarket and it says it's some form of juice and then you look on the back and it's mostly like apple and carrot.
Oh, yeah.
Because it's the cheap option for juicing. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I'm thinking wizards cheated. They mostly had apple and carrot juice and they just threw a little bit of pumpkin in and called it pumpkin juice.
Right.
Yeah. You know, V8 used to have these, V8 is a vegetable juice, and they used to have these fruit juices that would also have vegetables in them. And that's kind of what I think of. Yes, I used to love
That's what
those.
we used. We used those to sweeten the pumpkin tea.
Yeah,
They were
and it's got
good.
a little veggie, and it's a little thicker, but that's what I always thought of with pumpkin juice. It didn't occur to me until just now as you all were talking. I was like, when I think pumpkin juice, that's pretty much what I think of. And it doesn't taste vegetable-y. It was because it had a lot of apple
Yeah.
juice, I'm
And
sure.
like I think some pineapple juice maybe even, which is very sweet and very nice tasting.
Yeah, and so I guess, if you think about it, like the pumpkin figures in a lot of wizarding food. It's not just the juice, but we had in fact named our episode last time pumpkin pasties. But there are all kinds of little pumpkiny things that suggest that it's a hot trend in the wizarding world,
And
not
something called
perhaps
pumpkin fizz.
pumpkin fizz. That's
What
what
is
it
pumpkin
is.
fizz? It's
It's
up to you.
suggestive though. Yeah. Is it a candy? Oh, maybe, I don't know. Maybe it's a pop.
It's when you pour champagne on top of pumpkin juice.
Okay.
Also vodka.
Yeah.
The great thing about the pumpkin juice that we used to make is it was a great mixer.
Now, Emma, you also mentioned that you thought that the Beaubaton carriage is even pumpkin shaped.
Yeah, lots of pumpkins. And I can't help but think there is some sort of, I guess, connection there with, paganism, even though, the authors clearly deny that that's an association. I have differing thoughts on that because I can see a lot of pagan associations across those books. But yeah, there's a lot of pumpkin symbolism going on outside of just the foods, as like Hagrid's house. He's got a pumpkin patch where he grows these giant
Oh,
pumpkins,
yeah.
and
And he grows them for the Halloween feast, right? To become jack-o'-lanterns, doesn't he? Isn't that the whole point?
I think so, yeah. The carriage is pumpkin shaped. It's like pumpkin, pumpkin, pumpkin everywhere.
All right, well, I'm curious to ask Emma about something because Emma, I know you've done some research into Norse mythology and you have some ideas about how the food in Potter is related to the way it's treated in Norse mythology and other traditions.
I do have thoughts, particularly around mead, because we don't see just anyone drinking mead in the Potter series. It's most closely associated with Dumbledore and Hagrid, who are very much like Odin and Thor. And we could do a whole episode on that, with the associations between the two. But mead in itself is called the nectar of the gods and the honeymoon drink. And it was produced in a time before agriculture because you make it out of honey, not out of grain. So it's very old, and it's got particular associations with both Norse and Greek pantheons, which still sort of persist through to this day. But there's one tale in the Norse myths in particular called the Mead of Poetry, and it's where Odin goes to absolute great lengths to steal and obtain this mead of poetry, which will turn the drinker into a scald or a scholar and an expert poet. So he goes through deception and trickery in order to obtain this mead of poetry. And when we see Dumbledore, he's got an association with mead as well. And Dumbledore's a very Odin-like figure in many ways. He's a grey wanderer. He craves knowledge, which he often keeps to himself, and he's a bit secretive about his knowledge. He's very magically powerful, but he's also something of a trickster. And apart from Dumbledore's middle name being Wulfric and that association with wolves, Dumbledore and Odin are both queer as well. So there's a lot of connection between those characters, and there's some key moments where we see Dumbledore associated with mead that play to that tale of the mead of poetry. So when we see Aberforth serving the trio mead in Hogsmeade, ironically, before they break into Hogwarts, Aberforth is giving them information. He's playing that role of the scald, and he's talking about his brother, which is in a very Odin-like way, because he's saying that, look, Dumbledore has a lot of knowledge and he's very smart, but do you really trust him? Saying he's a bit of a trickster. He says secrets and lies. So he's talking about Dumbledore in a way that sort of poses him as this own like figure. He's powerful and he's knowledgeable, yes, but do you really trust him 100%? And on the flip side of that, we also see Albus with Mead when he summons it in Privet Drive and beats the Dursleys around the head with it. They refuse the mead and they drink it, so they don't become wise. But Harry does drink the mead and he gains a lot of knowledge from that. And in that scene, what stands out to me is it's one of the few times we see Albus in both kind mode and ticked off mode. So it's like that light and dark thing. And that, again, that's that very sort of Odin-like way of being.
Wow, that's fascinating.
I love that scene. Now it's even more significant.
Yeah, it's beautifully meaningful when you look at it from that significance of Mead being related to knowledge and wisdom. But the other association is obviously Hagrid, because Mead is Hagrid's favourite drink. And it was also Thor's favourite drink. And those two characters are exceedingly similar, not in the only in the fact that they drink staggering quantities of mead, but they're both strong and mighty. Mm-hmm. Thor's lineage also happens to be that of part giant. So they're both part giants. They're big, they're beardy, they're working class, and they're both charged with protecting loved ones. So Thor is the protector of Midgard or of Earth, and Hagrid also plays that very protective role. And interestingly, they both have an association with oak. So Hagrid with his oak wand, and Thor's got an association mm-hmm. with the oak tree. And it's also in their feminine, surprisingly feminine qualities. So we know about Hagrid, you know, wearing aprons and getting the dragon to call him mummy and knitting things. But what listeners might not know is that Thor also once dressed up in a wedding dress and pretended to be the goddess Freya in order to get his hammer back from a giant. So there's also this lovely juxtaposition of these very masculine characters who also have these protective, loving qualities and also some surprisingly feminine moments.
I love that. Oh my gosh, there's so much there.
There really is.
And I like how the food ties it all together as well.
Right. It all starts with the mead, right? I feel like there's a paper there, Emma.
Mead, glorious mead.
I mean, I'm even thinking of the name Hogsmeade, you know, for the town. Seems really significant now to me.
I was going to say, I did also go out and find one other thing with Norse mythology, which was quite interesting in this abundance of magically appearing food. So I'm going to attempt to pronounce something in Norse at the moment, but there's a Sæhrimnir, which is the cosmic boar. And the boar is slaughtered every night and fed to the gods and the warriors in Valhalla, and then is resurrected every day, and that cycle continues on. And Thor's goats.
Jiminy. The boar is in its own personal hell. My gosh.
Yeah. And Thor's goats as well. Thor has two goats that pull his chariot, and famously he can eat the goats and then wrap the bones back in the skins, bless them with his hammer, and they are resurrected. So this idea of food being in perpetual abundance, and to me that's like Hogwarts. Like there is never a shortage of food at Hogwarts. The house elves never forget to go shopping. There's always dinner on the table.
They're not allowed to forget is the thing.
Well, I mean, it's not like Hogwarts doesn't seem to be cracking the whip. They're internally motivated, these house elves at Hogwarts, I think.
I'm sure something happened hundreds of years ago and they learned not to forget.
No, well, yes. I mean, maybe. Yeah. I don't know. Shopping? Where are they shopping?
I don't know. They're just summoning things. They're magical.
They order it online.
Amazon delivers.
Well, Emma, you had also pointed out to us after our last episode how you see some connection between sweets and rebellion in the series, and even to the point where you think sweets might be a signifier of rebellion. How do you figure that?
Anytime sweets turns up, there seems to be something rebellious going on. When I think about all the times that there's something sweet available, and it starts with the conversation Harry has with Hagrid in Diagon Alley over ice cream about, you know, better be in Hufflepuff than in Slytherin. And, you know, it's about Harry not fitting in and not feeling like he's got a place. And it continues onto the Hogwarts Express, where his first instinct is buy as many Mars bars as possible. And everything even on the trolley is sweet. So, it's skiving snack boxes. It's even Mrs. Fig giving Harry chocolate cake, even though she's not supposed to, because she knows the Dursleys will hate it that Harry's having some enjoyment.
To get to Honeydukes, Harry also has to sneak out, and he gets in to Hogsmeade through Honeydukes.
He sneaks out, uses the map, uses the cloak, goes somewhere he's not supposed to. Where does he end up? Honeydukes.
Sweet job. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, that's even the teachers. He does the interview in the Quibbler, and Umbridge hates it. So Flitwick gives him sugar mites. And then you've got the whole have a biscuit, Potter.
Mm-hmm.
Love that one.
I don't know. Louise, what do you think? You want to chime in on this? Do you have any sense of how the sweets might be related to rebellion? Well, or?
I mean, of course, when you immediately said sweets, I thought of Dudley, of course, and how greedy he is for sugar and sweets and things like that. Like when we think about the zoo outing, about, you know, Harry actually accessing sweets, which is something of a rarity for him. You know, they Uncle Vernon buys him that cheap lemon ice pop that he, while he's getting Dudley and his friend chocolate ice cream, and then he. You know, Dudley has the tantrum because his Knickerbocker Gory doesn't have enough ice cream on it or whipped cream on it or whatever. And then Harry's allowed to finish Dudley's leftovers. And so Harry is getting sweets. And then he does this act, of course, accidentally, but setting the snake on Dudley and immediately. So I think that's a connection to that as well. Once he gets access to the sweets, he, taps into kind of his magic.
Yeah. Dudley. What about how Hagrid, introduces himself to Harry with this birthday cake in a way, and the birthday cake then becomes, like you say, a kind of entree into magical world. It's sort of his welcome is this big sticky cake that Hagrid brings with him.
Dobby uses the pudding, the violet pudding that he smashes.
Oh yeah.
To get Harry in trouble and to keep him away from Hogwarts at that point too. So we have all of those instances. I'm also was remembering, it's interesting, Harry is getting sweets and things like that sent to him from his friends over the summer. Once they figure out he's being starved at home, they start sending him rock cakes and sweets and chocolates and things like that. But then there's that one point when in Order of the Phoenix, where he's so angry at them that he throws all the sweets away and is like rejecting that overture as well.
It's funny because the birthday cakes he gets sent, that's clear defiance of the diet he's supposed to be on. When everyone else is eating grapefruit, he's upstairs eating cake for breakfast. And even that scene, Louise, that you brought up with the zoo, he's not supposed to be there at all. He's only there because Mrs. Fig broke a leg and the Dursleys don't want him there in the first place. So,
right. And he's bought the cheapest sweets they can find,
he was embarrassed, that the lady asked him, what do you want, before he could hustle Harry away. And
right.
It's like, oh yeah, I've got to buy him something too. Otherwise I'm going to look bad. So, okay.
The Weasley twins also are always associated with sweets. So they're either stealing stuff from the kitchens or from Honeydukes, or they're making skiving snack boxes. They're feeding Dudley tongue toffee, but they, couldn't be more rebellious, but they're continually associated with sweets as well.
And you don't see a lot of sweets during the camping trip during Deathly Hallows, when they're so deprived of everything. You there are almost no sweets available during those times of near starvation too.
Yeah, very interesting. I wonder if, let's turn our attention now to kind of the fandom and fan food, because I'm going to guess that we've all prepared Potter-themed food and beverages at some point. Why do you think it is that we do that? Why, you know, why is that, in fact, like one of the first things that we think to do when we, you know, when we read these books, as opposed to like, I mean, I guess people are making Star Wars food, but not that much. It's the Star Wars food, like, it's not as interesting maybe, but why are we all so interested in wizard food?
Why do we want to eat these books?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, I mean, food is just over and over and over. I mean, it's so prevalent and talked about so much. Again, not just in Harry Potter, but in all of Rowling's works, in Cormoran Strike, in the Ichabod, in The Crystal Pig,
yes,
various things like that. That I mean, there is just this theme of food over and over again, in the way that you don't see food in Star Wars or Star Trek or some of these other fantasies.
Nobody wants food from the replicator.
Yeah, right. I think we do this in part, you know, it's the same reason we get, you know, our Ravenclaw house scarves or ties or robes or wands. I mean, it's a way of immersing ourselves into this world. And because food is such an important part of this world, we immerse ourselves in it when we eat. I mean, I have a little plastic mold made of in the shape of frogs down in my kitchen now that, you know, I got it for my son's, I think, 8th birthday party when he wanted a Harry Potter party. And so we made chocolate frogs. And so we just melted down chocolate and poured into the mold. And okay, we have chocolate frogs. You know, we try homemade butterbeer recipes. We try just British food in general, steak and kidney pie and bangers and mash and all this type of stuff that we hear them eating it. I did not know what treacle tart was until I read Harry Potter. And I went to Foods of All Nations and got some good dark corn syrup. And I made my first treacle tart as a part of a Harry Potter party. And we do that to immerse ourselves into it. The same reason we might put on a Marauder's Map scarf to go to a professional meeting or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, I'm struck by what you say, Louise, partly because I think we're once again seeing like the bridge between British culture and wizard culture and some of what you described there. And there's this little Anglophilia that's coming through, you know, as a former colony that we have a little bit of that. And seeing some of our differences in and appreciating and enjoying those. And also I'm thinking about how sensory food is as an experience, in that it engages really all the senses. And so that immersive quality that you were talking about really comes through, because you are seeing, smelling, feeling, tasting in the company of, you know, this thing that's supposed to be a part of the Harry Potter series, the Wizarding World.
It helps us express what attracts us to the series. Because I'm thinking about, like, I'm always asking myself, well, not always, but I often ask myself, my expression of my fandom of Harry Potter is the food and the drinks. And my expression of my fandom of Star Wars is the costumes. And I just think Star Wars does costumes really well, you know, and it's part of what attracted people to that galaxy, you know, and has since 1977, is that, man, they just look cool, you know. Even the goofy looking ones look really cool. And you're just struck by these questions of how do they do that, you know? And I think that in Harry Potter, the attraction is the food, and the way, like we've explained, the way that sweets are associated with rebellion, and rebellion is associated with the good characters, you know, and the good characters are associated with magic, you know, and that really hooks us in and makes us want to be part of that world. And so I think that it's a special character or charism of the franchise itself that really comes out in fan expression of their fandom.
Yeah. And as Louise had said, you know, food is so prominent in the books themselves that it,
oh, yeah.
it definitely becomes, that's what you're so, that's what you want to, you know, participate in. Emma, what do you think?
I think because part of it's because it's portrayed as such a glorious thing in the series, whether or not you're reading Harry's description of how much he enjoys the food mm-hmm. or you're watching the kids' reactions in the movies when the food magically appears on the tables.
Right.
It's portrayed as such, you don't see Luke Skywalker like smacking his lips with delight when he drinks the blue milk. Let's put it that way. So it's the character's yeah. reaction to that food that really makes a difference. But it's also like some of it's a little bit dangerous and exciting. So yeah. as someone who's still part of the Commonwealth and probably used to a lot of British food, steak and kidney pie doesn't thrill me so much. But right. what interests me is edgy stuff like Bertie Bott's Evro flavor beans that could end in wondrous taste or absolute disaster, or you know, cockroach clusters which are a bit dangerous, or you know, even
fizzing Whisbees.
I was fizzing Whisbees make you levitate. Like, how cool is that? Even if it is made out of billywig stings. So there's this sort of also edgy, dangerous nature, particularly to some of the sweet shop sweets, which I find fascinating. I think people are like, ooh, I really want to try that because it sounds delicious, but it also sounds a bit exciting.
A bit risky.
Thrilling food.
Yeah.
yeah. Well, I remember Hermione when she was going to Honeydukes and was thinking about getting, what was it she wanted to get her for her parents, was the candy floss, dental floss type something that would, it was like a peppermint candy floss that would clean your teeth.
Oh yeah.
I mean, what's more perfect than that is to have a sugary sweet candy that actually is good for your teeth. What better gift for a pair of dentists than the sugary stuff that actually cleans your teeth rather than rots them.
Right. There's something for everyone.
And you can just sort of undo this, you know, this bad stuff that sugar is for your teeth. I mean, that's,
and I love just that logic. Undo all the sugar that you've eaten with more sugar.
Well, listeners, have we stirred your appetite for your favorite magical foods? We are going to now turn to our special segment for today, where we are visiting the Hogwarts kitchens to share some fun recipes with you. We're going to start with Emma's recipe for cockroach clusters. And Emma, you shared this recipe with us, and I was like, I have to make this. So walk us through this recipe that you made and the context for which you made your cockroach clusters.
So I'm really glad you tried these, by the way. And they came
so much fun.
Great success.
Yeah, very successful. All gone.
I made them for a party, a Harry Potter themed party, and I got a bit carried away with that. I decorated my entire house, but I really wanted to have like almost a Honeydukes thing for dessert at the end of the night. So I thought, I'm going to make cockroach clusters because they just sound so revolting. So I wanted something that looked revolting and almost cockroachy, and was a little bit texturally challenging as well, because when you bite into it, I kind of wanted to be a bit oozy and a bit crunchy, and it's like, oh, you know that feeling you get underfoot when you step on a cockroach?
Oh
yeah, I kind of wanted to
thankfully no that. I don't know that.
So this is my recipe. It's actually quite simple. So take some peanut butter. I like to use crunchy peanut butter, and get some of those the Chinese deep fried sort of crispy noodles that you can buy, you know, at the store in the packets, the deep fried ones, no flavoring on it. And then add some dried fruit of your choice. So I like sultanas. Katie, I know you use cherries.
Yes, and so I don't care for raisins, so I did cherries, and I just, because they were a little large, I cut them in half so it would be about the same size as a raisin.
So any dried fruit of your choice. So you've got that little chewy element in there. So you mix the noodles, the fruit, and the peanut butter together, and blob them into cockroach-sized blobs. And then put those in the fridge until they cool down and harden a little bit. And then the last step is to cover them in some melted chocolate, you know, milk or dark, whatever you fancy. But the idea is that once they're reset in the fridge, you'll get that outer shell of chocolate, hopefully with a little bit of noodly bits poking out, so they look like legs and antennas. And then when you bite into them, they're sort of got this gooey peanut in the middle, the crunchy noodle, and then that chewy element of the dried fruit.
I have to tell you, these totally satisfy in the way that they are delicious and also a little cockroachy in the sense that they have, as you say, Emma, that textural component that is a little strange. It's a little challenging, I believe was the word that you used. And I found that to coat them, I was not very good at coating them with the chocolate. I did it in two, this was going to be my tip. I did it in two little things where I drizzled the chocolate over the top, and I used both milk and dark chocolate to see which one was better. And of course they were equally good. It's all good. And then I let that sit in the fridge for like an hour, and then I pulled them out and I turned them over so I could get the sides and the bottoms on a second one. And the chocolate in the first coat, it held them together so that I could do the rest of them. And that worked really well. And they were so good. My daughter also thought I could have used more of the cherries. And so you can be kind of generous with your dried fruit. You know, I think it was so funny because Emma, I'm a baker, but I'm not a cook. And so I did send like a follow-up question like about measurement and so on. And you were like, use the force, Katie. Yeah. we'll have intersecting fandoms there. Use the force.
I cook and I rarely measure things, which is why I'm a terrible baker, because you normally have to follow a recipe.
It's very measury. Yeah. But I want to assure people that you can do this without the measuring. You know, you're just going to look at what, you know, what looks like the right proportions, and it's not going to be bad. Whatever you do here is not going to, it's not going to be bad. And so I ended up making 27. That's just how many came out of it. And I kept them in the fridge in a Ziploc bag, and I made them just a few days ago and they are gone. So they were gobbled up, and we had such a fun time with them. And of course I had to share them with some of my friends, and oh, it was just so much fun. I enjoyed it.
You had me with chocolate and peanut butter. So
yeah,
they are deliciously revolting.
Deliciously revolting. Revoltingly delicious. It was all good. Yeah. Now, Louise, you also have a recipe for us. As a scientist, you actually did a little butterbeer experiment, which I quite enjoyed hearing about that. So tell us what your butterbeer experiment was and how it turned out.
This was several years ago now, but there was a club that it was called Virginia's for Wizards. It was a Virginia Harry Potter fan club that was started actually by one of my former students. And so I had volunteered to host an event in my home. And one of the things I was doing was butterbeer tasting. So, and it was fun because there were some research students who were working at Mary Baldwin over the summer, and one of the chemistry professors brought over a bunch of students. So we had a really good time, but I had like four different recipes. I had one that was alcoholic that was only for adults, but then I had just some commercial butter beer. I think it was the Flying Cauldron butterscotch beer soda. You can buy that commercially. It's sold in a lot of Harry Potter festivals. But then there were a couple of I tried a couple of different recipes, and there was one that was very complicated. You had to mix up your own butterscotch syrup with brown sugar and butter and boil it to a certain temperature and use the candy thermometer to make sure it's the right one, and then cool it and then mix it with cream soda. And it was the from scratch butterbeer recipe. And then there was this other very easy one, which was basically take a 2-liter bottle of cream soda and you pour in, you stick a funnel at the top of it and you pour in, I think it was 2 tablespoons of butter extract and 2 teaspoons of rum extract. And so it's just the soda and the extracts, and you put them together, you put the top on, you swirl it very gently so it doesn't lose the carbonation. Well, so there was this very complex recipe of all homemade everything, and then there was this very quick mix one. And when we did finally did the taste testing, it was the quick one that was rated highest of all the Butterbeer recipes we had. So
classic. I love that.
Like, okay, I'd never have to worry about making homemade butterbeer again, right, with homemade syrup or anything. It's just open the bottle, dump in the extract, and you're done. And then, you know, if you really want to make it fancy, you mix like a 7-ounce jar of marshmallow fluff with a cup of whipping cream and dump in a little bit of about a teaspoon of rum extract, whip that up as the topping, and, you know, put a dollop of that on top. And then you have this nice fizzy butterbeer, and then the sweet topping on top. And it makes a very, very, very good butterbeer recipe. And yum, it turns out that it was the easiest recipe, and it was also the highest rated. So
yeah. And obviously that's your sweet butterbeer.
Yes.
We don't have a near beer butterbeer.
Very sweet butterbeer. Now the alcoholic butterbeer was quite good too. I had that on, actually, I had some friends over the night, the Hogwarts Tournament of Houses premiered.
Oh,
we were watching that. And we had the adult butterbeer then. That's quite good too. That is a mixture of butterscotch schnapps and whipped cream flavored vodka and cream soda. That's quite good too. But that's, again, adults only for that one.
Mm-hmm. Right. Wow. Those are great tips, fun recipes. Listeners, if you try some of these recipes, let us know how they turn out. And if you have favorite recipes for your Potter foods, please pass them along to us. We'd love to hear what you're working on, and also maybe try them for ourselves. We're game. We're ready,
yes,
to
please.
Try. That brings us to the end of our episode considering cockroach clusters and blabbing about butterbeer. Thanks so much to our guests, Louise and Emma, for joining us today.
Oh, our pleasure. I need to go downstairs and mix myself up some butterbeer, I think.
Thanks, Katie. It left me decidedly brain empty and also very hungry.
Right. Brain empty.
Great combo. Great combo.
Yeah. Well, I thought I would close with a classic scene between Professor McGonagall and Harry from Harry Potter and the Order of the Phoenix, which we referenced just a little bit earlier in the episode. "Is it true that you shouted at Professor Umbridge?" "Yes," said Harry. "You called her a liar?" "Yes." "You told her he who must not be named is back?" "Yes." Professor McGonagall sat down behind her desk, frowning at Harry. Then she said, "Have a biscuit, Potter." "Have what?" "Have a biscuit," she repeated impatiently, indicating a tartan tin of cookies lying on top of one of the piles of paper on her desk.
We hope you have enjoyed this episode of Potterversity. Send us your thoughts on the episode or propose ideas for future episodes by writing to potterversitypodcast@gmail.com. If you like the show, consider leaving a review on iTunes. And be sure to follow Potterversity on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Potterversity is brought to you by MuggleNet, the number one Wizarding World resource since 1999. Emma Nicholson is technical director, and the show is produced by Laurie Beckoff. Our theme music is performed by The Town, featuring Sean Elsburn, Scott Hacker, Travis Princey, Ashley Shepherd, and Emily Strand, and produced by Sean Elsburn. I'm your announcer, Dr. Sarah Brown.
Until next time, class dismissed.